writes about biodiversity loss and climate change and how these issues intersect. He's been thinking about new and different ways to tell environmental stories that engage readers and get them to care, which is what led him to propose this panel on rethinking how we cover extinction. So, Benji, over to you.
Thank you. All right, so first of all, thanks for being here, everyone. Thanks for panelists for showing up. I wrote a story last spring about how one-fifth of all reptiles are at risk of extinction, and almost no one read it. After it was published, I also talked to a friend who covered the same news at a much bigger publication, and she told me the same thing. Not a lot of people were drawn to this story. I tried my best not to fixate on metrics of engagement like page views or total minutes, but I still find it frustrating that a lot of the stories that I find to be very newsworthy about extreme declines of biodiversity, I find it frustrating that they don't seem to get a lot of attention. And a fun fact is that since I started at Vox 2 years ago, this is my top read story, which is about dogs and other animals eating cicadas. a lot of the other stories that I write are more about kind of depressing things about what's happening to the planet, but even also some of the conservation stories that are more hopeful just don't get the same amount of attention. And I get it, I often don't want to read some of these stories myself. They're sad, they often follow the same kind of narrative about species in decline. And there also is some research that I was trying to pull up just a couple days ago showing that people are becoming numb to some of the narratives in the environmental movement. There are a lot of different terms for this. Some have called it degradation desensitization, psychic numbing, disassociation, empathetic over-arousal. And so I'm personally often trying to think about ways to bring more people into our stories, ways to break through a lot of this kind of numbing effect that I've seen among our audience, both in the numbers, et cetera, but also just talking to folks. And so that's why I'm so excited to have this panel today to talk through these issues. And we have a really expert panel with us, environmental author Michelle Niehaus, biographic editor-in-chief Stephen Bedard, and photojournalist Karen Hagner. So thanks all for being with us. And to kick us off, I'm going to have them each introduce themselves and talk a bit about how they're pushing back on some common narratives and getting creative in their own storytelling.
Stories about extinction and the opposite of extinction pretty much since the beginning of my career. And two things that I feel as a writer and an editor that I'm always trying to push back against are our tendency to use the drama of extinction for narrative fuel. Obviously, extinction is such an important story. We have to cover it. But I see too often that we are relying on the stakes of extinction to be the stakes of our story, to be the tension in our story. And to me, that's the end of the story of conservation, and it's the tragic end of the story of conservation. There's so much more to talk about, and I think, not that I figured out how to do this myself, but there is tension and drama in efforts to restore and protect and conserve other species, and we have to find ways to use that tension to draw readers in. And the second thing that I'm always trying to push back against is the lone hero narrative that so many of our editors, want and demand. They want the cinematic narrative with a beginning and a middle and an end, and a clean, confrontation of obstacles with hopefully a clear, satisfying resolution. conservation, I mean, you guys covered this, conservation doesn't work that way. I mean, leaders are important, and I've seen many wonderful stories about conservation leaders who did have a breakthrough idea, but most of the time, conservation is accomplished by groups of people and networks of people, and it moves very slowly. So again, in the same way as I want to find the drama in restoration and conservation, I want to find the drama in efforts to work together to accomplish conservation, because I feel like otherwise it's counterproductive. If we as journalists imply that the only way to make a difference in conservation is to act by yourself and have a brilliant idea, that leaves out 99.5% of us. You know, we have to show that there are ways for the ordinary rest of us to make a big difference, have a positive effect on conservation. So I just want to quickly show you three stories that I felt like did those things well. First one is from High Country News this fall. There's some copies of it floating around, covering a non-charismatic species that's not close to extinction, the lamprey, and also talking about its very deep cultural connection with the tribes of the Columbia River. And the tribes, to their great credit, have really leaned into kind of the weird charisma of the lamprey. And there's an extremely popular exhibit, apparently, with kids at Oregon Zoo showing the lamprey. They all want to see it now. So this story also just leans into this crazy critter and its ecosystem and the deep human connection with it that really extends over millennia. Secondly, this is a story I edited from The Atlantic by Ben Goldfarb. This is a adapted version of this is a chapter in Ben's book, which is coming out in the fall. It's wonderful. It's called Crossings. It's about road ecology. And this is about how do we address roadkill systematically. There's a scientist, there's actually a named creature in here, which we talked about the power of treating creatures as individuals. But there is no lone hero. And finally, Scotland's billionaires are turning climate change into a trophy game. Also, sorry, I edited for The Atlantic. This really digs into the cultural weight of land ownership and the history of land ownership in Scotland and how that's intersecting with conservation and restoration and climate change and carbon credits. So all very creative stories. There's no, of course, no one single answer, but I really look forward to hearing ideas from you and the rest of the panelists.
Thank you all for being here, and thank you, Benji, for organizing this panel. It's definitely, so my name is Stephen Bedard. I'm the editor of Biographic Magazine. We're an independent publication that focuses on nature, conservation, and increasingly solutions to the biodiversity crisis. We created the magazine 7 years ago, specifically to respond to some of what Benji was talking about, the doom and gloom reporting, to some extent what Michelle was talking about, sort of the individual hero at the center of the story, and none of that feels complete or authentic to us. And of course, there's no shortage of issues and problems in the world. We're faced with them all the time. But we also know that the overabundance of stories like these causes people to tune out and to disengage. Great imagery, like this photo here of a California newt, is definitely one piece of the puzzle for us. We invest heavily in it. Cannon has published work with Biographic, and Michelle has written a story for us, and so it's a couple of things. It's taking a highly visual approach to our storytelling. It's making sure we're investing in field reporting and investing or being committed to long form storytelling, which means that we can tell these complex stories in all their nuance and complexity and challenges and introduce them to multiple introduce readers to multiple characters and scenes. So to put a little more nuance on this, we do there are a couple of approaches to our visual storytelling and our long form storytelling. The Newt story that I that we looked at a couple of minutes ago. One of the things that a story like this and a key focus of the story is this species or multiple species of newts, which are highly endangered in a lot of places. They're facing many, many threats, but there is also a really wonderful story of resilience just in the species itself. And we like to tell stories about resilience just to begin with. This next image is of a marsh, one marsh at a place called Cuatro Ciénagas in central Mexico. And the story of this is not about a single hero story, it is about a team, but there is a central character, a microbiologist named Valeria Souza, who's been working for decades to save these primordial marshlands in central Mexico, and her efforts to do that. So it's a very cool science story, and also an important ecosystem restoration story and protection story. This next one, I would say, is one of my favorite examples where it all kind of comes together, and we don't often have these experiences where we have a charismatic species, a bizarre animal called a greater adjutant, which is the largest stork in the world. They have adapted in parts of India. This story takes place in the region of Assam, and they spend a lot of their time in landfills and obtain most of their nutrients from what they find in the landfills. And so they are right alongside the trash picker humans, who also are forced to rely on these resources for their own survival. So we have a charismatic species. We also have a charismatic central character, a woman by the name of Purnima Devi Barman. She is a local from Assam. She is a PhD biologist, and she has taken it upon herself to protect this bird, to study it and know what the major threats are and to try to eliminate those. But a huge part of what she does is this community outreach to educate local people about this species that was once reviled. And she has enlisted what she calls her Hargila army. Hargila is it's the name for the greater adjutant in Assam. Her Hargila army is made up of all women, and their whole mission is to change hearts and minds and to get people to love this crazy species that that once was persecuted. And numbers are increasing. The community is benefiting from the sale of goods that they produce to help protect the Hargila. And it is just one of those stories where we're always looking for that kind of combination of factors and characters, both species and places, but also the people who are working to protect them. And so I'll go ahead and end with that and pass along to Karen. I just wanted to say the last thing. All of these approaches, when we're looking for the charismatic species, when we're looking for the individual who's kind of fighting against all odds, the whole reason for doing that, our whole motivation for doing that, is aimed at, as I said before, inspiring people, giving them hope, and helping them to believe that all is not lost.
Hi everyone, I'm Karen Eigner, photographer. There's a picture of me somewhere. I'm about 6 years old on my bed surrounded by stuffed animals. I didn't have it to show you today. And so I don't know where my interest in animals came from because my parents weren't naturalists or really into the environment, but they gave me the opportunities wherever we live to have pets. So I was the kid finding lizards, saving kittens, rescuing snakes, and giving all our pets, you know, proper burials in the backyard. Don't know where that came from. I connected on my own with animals, but I've learned over the years that not everybody has that opportunity. As a photographer who covers wildlife stories, many of them are science-based. I tried for a long time not to anthropomorphize. I was told by the experts, you know, that's bad, don't give animals human qualities. But then I met Momcat, the completely wild bobcat who allowed me into her world for years. And she and her family has taught me that it's the individuals who have the lessons to teach. I don't have to give them human qualities. They have qualities that are their own, all right? They're active beings with biographies. And I believe we begin to make a difference as journalists when we celebrate those individuals. We have to connect our audience with the individual lives, who they are, and what they experience, where they live, is what people actually react to, and that helps us as humans understand and empathize. Bobcats have the same real lives we do. Momcat, LG, Chirpy, they all have deeply different personalities, different ways of parenting, different favorite napping spots, different hunting strategies, different intelligences, different human tolerances and trusts. They're mothers, fathers, sisters, cousins, friends, and neighbors. And I've actually seen all this and documented it, so it's not like I'm making it up along the way. Along the way, though, I use social media to tell these stories about them. I know for a fact, through the engagement that I had and the personal messages I received, that once people actually identified with these animals as individuals, was as they did through my Bobcat Chronicles, they began to ask questions. They wanted to know more. They began to empathize and care and pay attention and actually act and do something in their own communities. People who didn't care before then even began to pester me because I wasn't posting updates. How's Momcat? Like, I would get these questions if I hadn't posted them all. How's Momcat? Why aren't you telling us more? Where are the bobcats? We tend to talk more generally about species in the stories that we do and the stories that I read, and less about the individuals. And for me, in my opinion, it needs to be the other way around. We need to create a primary connection for our viewers and readers and an experience they can relate with. Something they can understand. So it's my goal as a photographer to show these personalities. People care more about a place and an ecosystem when they know who is in it. And as we already know, when they care, they're more willing to act and to pay attention. So I myself cared more about the world bobcats live in after and during my experiences with them. I'm not gonna show you all the bad things I learned. This is just good stuff up here. But I'm a proponent of the fact that we need to know our neighbors in order to save them and their homes, and their homes is also our home. And that's Momcat.
These photos are amazing. So cute. So I want to get into some of what you all talked about in terms of presenting animals as individuals or even plants as individuals and covering conservation before the kind of end-all of extinction. But before then, before we get there, I want to start with a sort of baseline setting question, which is just, what is the purpose of our work? What do you see as the goal of our work as environmental journalists? Is it to frighten people into getting concerned about biodiversity loss by talking about extreme declines? Is it showing cuddly animals and getting people interested in animals that way? What do you see as the purpose of environmental journalism? And anyone can take that question.
Thank you.
grew up at High Country News, which is a nonprofit, mission-driven publication, so I may have a different definition of the purpose of my work than some of you do, and be interested to talk about that. But the High Country News mission is one that I've taken through my career as a journalist, and it is to inform our readers and to inspire them to act on behalf of places in the West and their inhabitants, whether they are human or non-human. And so I do see my job as not only informing people about the complicated science, the complicated politics, the complicated social and cultural issues surrounding conservation, but to inspire them to participate in those efforts. And that's why I was talking about the lone hero narrative. It's important for me to represent how ways in which ordinary people can finish the story and then participate in a way that doesn't require them to transform their lives, but inspires them to practice conservation in their lives as they are.
Yeah, I would echo almost all of that. I think for me, even though I came from a slightly different background and was not part of a newsroom until much more recently, 10 years or so, I've always just felt that it begins with telling good stories, but specifically with this magazine, our mission is to give people hope and really to not advocate for anything other than being informed and caring, because I think it begins with that. And I find, I think if those skip tactics worked, I might be more inclined to do it. And again, we're not ever shying away from the severity of issues and problems. We just want to, the story can't end there for us. We want it to be, so now what? So now what are people doing to address this problem?
I mean, ditto what these guys have just said. If I think about it personally, a lot of times I'll read something and I want to do something, but then I feel like it's too big. It's like, oh, cool, this is horrible, but like, what can I do? I can't do anything. I live in the city or whatever my situation is. And I've seen so many presentations and things where there's no ask at the end. And I think as, environmental journalists, I think one of the things, obviously, that we want to do is get people to activate, to move, to do something. But sometimes they don't know what to do. So I feel sometimes like using social media and using my own voice, I make personal connections. And when I hear them say, because people do contact me, when people say to me, oh, I wish I could do something. And I'll say, you can. There's a petition. Sign it. All you have to do is click here. Whatever it is. And then the funny thing is, they get back to me, they're like, oh my God, thank you for responding. Like, I didn't think you'd even answer me. So here I'm thinking, all we want individually is connection and to know that someone's got our back and someone else is doing it too. So I feel like that's part of what we need to be doing is not just telling our stories, but almost having bullet points at the end, like here's four simple things you can do, because people don't think they can do anything. They think it's too big and their one little thing that they do doesn't matter when it actually does. Because when they see the repercussions from it, like if let's say the poll gets the thing done, they're like, oh, that was really cool. And then I can say, see, your vote mattered. And it makes a difference to them.
So a common thread in this is getting people to do something. And so I want to dig in a bit deeper into some of what you mentioned in your intro talks, and maybe starting with you, Karen, about how do we bring out the individuality of animals and of plants? I'm curious what that looks like from a photography perspective. Is that something that you think about when you're taking photos of bobcats or of animals that maybe don't have as similar family structures as, I don't know, we do?
You mean like a rattlesnake?
Yeah, yeah. Or like, how do you make insects individuals?
photographically, you can use different techniques. I mean, there are visual techniques, different lenses, different technology I can use to actually get you closer to those animals so that when you open up the pages or look at the images, you're like, whoa, it's so cute, or, you know, where you actually connect with it in that way, so you want to know more. You know, I keep going back to social media, but I really have used it as a way to try and dispel myths, to get people to like rattlesnakes. That's been a mission of mine, because everyone hates snakes, and that's like the common response to any snake post that I post, like, ooh, no, big exclamation mark, or, you know, something like that. And I engage those people in conversation, and I'll ask, so why did you say that? Have you had a bad experience? And then we get into a discussion. But a lot of the reactions I get are from the way that I portray the animals.
And so when it comes to rattlesnakes, for example, like what would a photo look like that would maybe portray it in a way that makes it less threatening or less stereotypical?
I'm not sure. You know, I'd have to show you the images. Okay. I like to use these, for animals like that, I like to wait for a moment, you know, not show it in the typical aggressive, you know, mouth open or all wound up, because that's the strike position, and that's what freaks everybody out. Look how mean it is, you know. So I use video, I'll show people rattlesnakes, I'll follow them. And it's not engaging. It wants to get away. It wants to have nothing to do with me, to just dispel this myth that they're going to attack you all the time. You know, I'll show proper behavior and that kind of thing. So for me, it's not just photography, but it's video and action and all this combined to really just try and dispel myths. How do you make a rattlesnake look cute and cuddly? I mean, I'm not sure I've gotten there yet, but I do like to use wide angle macro to bring you closer. And I don't know how to explain how I do it, but you know, a lot of people have said to me, wow, you make animals look like humans sometimes. And a friend of mine who's a, you know, an incredible photographer, she said, you always make animals look like these human figures. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then I looked at the pictures and I was like, wow, yeah, I do. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how. I think that's just my vision that I'm trying. It's just innate in my head. You know, I'm very selective about the images that I actually choose to show too, right? I don't just put anything out there. So everything that I put out on my Instagram feed, you know, I'm really assessing the image, going, do I want to show this? I've got rattlesnakes looking aggressive, but do I want to show that?
And Michelle and Stephen, as editors, do we have to be like, where do we draw the line with anthropomorphizing? I know that there has been a lot of pushback from the scientific community that we shouldn't make animals seem like humans because they're obviously not, they have different set of needs and whatever. But I'm wondering, should we be more comfortable doing that if it means getting people more empathetic?
We did try to make rattlesnakes cute and cuddly in a spotlight story that we published a while back, and it was it's a single image. Our spotlights are a single image in a natural history essay that goes along with it. But that image in particular, it was of an adult rattlesnake. I don't know if it was the mother, I believe it was, and a gigantic brood of rattlesnakes. I think a lot of people thought that was an adorable image, but I also know that it doesn't work for everyone. So I don't think our goal is to make animals cute and cuddly, or like Karen said, not to attach our own beliefs and behaviors onto those animals. I think there's plenty of science that we can cover that goes into behavior and natural history and life history and evolution, and we can make organisms absolutely fascinating without layering on our own ideas about them.
Meaning like individuality is separate from human life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the other thing in terms of just making subject matter more engaging for our audience, I mean, there's a reason we work with such fabulous photographers, and why we invest so much in the art for our stories is they bring those stories more to life than we could, no matter how good a writer we're working with. They just, they transport a reader to, you know, being face to face with that animal, being in that place, and then, you know, along with that, we provide the scientific context, and we provide the scenes that bring that story to life even more.
Yeah, I would agree that there's a ton of room between individual showing animals as individual beings and anthropomorphizing. We can show how they behave throughout their day. We can show how they relate to one another without imposing human assumptions on top of that. And I think I also think sometimes there's too much made of finding relatable animals, you know, animals that readers will find something in common with. And to me, it's like meeting someone from perhaps like a radically different culture, or someone who speaks a language that's completely foreign to us. I mean, you don't have to immediately see something in common with someone else to be fascinated by them. Like, what's your world like? And then to ultimately realize, oh, we have so many common interests. Like, you know, I have nothing in common with the lamprey, except that we are both trying to make our way in the world under, you know, occasionally challenging circumstances. And I think if you can open up a secret world that people don't know about, you can draw them in, and then show, you know, the real relatability between humans and other species, which runs very deep.
Yeah, on this point of species that may not be charismatic, I'm also thinking about plants and fungi and bacteria, like things that we don't see in the spotlight very much. And I'm wondering, especially with something like plants, and we talked briefly about this with Stephen before, but what is our moral obligation to cover these organisms that have less attention, that aren't necessarily big and charismatic and relatable? Should we be focusing more on those, just given that they have not been in the spotlight for so long? Should journalists be looking for stories outside of the big one, the big charismatic species?
I would love for us to find a way to get beyond single species stories in the first place. I mean, I think it's kind of like the lone hero narrative to do the single species narrative. Sometimes that's perfectly reasonable. I just want us to expand our toolbox and not always think, okay, we've got to focus on this guy. Tardigrade aside, it is really hard to find charismatic microfauna, you know, at least traditionally charismatic microfauna, you know, and so like elevating them to the main character, that's tough. I mean, I would love to read that story when someone does it successfully, but I think there are ways to sort of wow people with the incredible, the incredible way in which microscopic life is embedded in our lives, and, you know, the huge difference it makes to us. And there's, you know, all these stories about fungal blight coming out recently because of The Last of Us. And everyone is like, is that real? And, and the answer is, well, kind of. And then that becomes a very pressing and interesting question to people. What are these creatures I can't see, or what are these forms of life that I can't see mean to me in my everyday life, and why are they so important?
Yeah, how do we make plants pop the same way? We can't tell them as an individual beings. I guess they are.
I mean, it's hard unless you're a plant lover. Fortunately, I am, but I also know that, especially trees, we really struggled with those ecosystem scale stories in the beginning, and I think we're doing better with those. I think we've learned a lot. I think often there is a, there's some sort of effort. I mean, there needs to be a narrative. There needs to be people doing stuff within that environment to make the story interesting. And then it's their interactions with and work in that ecosystem with those plants, and sometimes with the animals that there as well. But there is stories like that. They're just sort of naturally diffuse. You don't have a face. It's easier if you have something like a giant sequoia or a bristlecone pine. I mean, way back when we did a story about pinyon juniper woodlands and kind of the encroachment of junipers into range that they hadn't occupied before. And that was my first experience trying to tell that kind of ecosystem scale story about a not particularly charismatic species or forest type. One could argue not as charismatic, but I remember thinking, ooh, this is a different type of story, and it's going to require more thinking about how we approach it.
And are there specific takeaways from that experience in terms of how do you structure a story, how do you bring out certain details that you feel like have worked for increasing engagement?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that narrative and what usually people are doing to improve things. I think probably the if I think back on that story, I've tried to put it out of my mind a little bit. But if I think back about what didn't work about it, is I think we were trying to tell just a fairly straight natural history story about this very slow, like watching paint dry, encroachment of one species into another type of habitat, and the action was just too slow, too minimal to sustain it.
Karen, have you had an experience where you were on assignment to shoot an ecosystem or a species or a group of animals or plants, and you had a really hard time just making the images look good because the subject matter wasn't that exciting in the first place? And if so, like, how did you get the images to shine?
Well, I mean, I have to laugh because I photographed an Audubon story, and it was a kestrel story, and it was, banding birds one more time. It was an environment, but you have to figure out a way to make it look interesting. And there is always a way. And I was, not photographically, but when you asked, do we have a moral obligation to tell these stories and how do we do it? I think, look, we're all creatives in this room, right? You're all journalists. We've all seen movies like Avatar, which is about plants too. There are ways to tell stories, to weave these tales, and to make them interesting. And I try and do it with cameras and pictures and the visual side, and sometimes you get stumped and you've got to figure out a different way to do it. I don't have an equation. I know it's easier with a charismatic animal, and I recently was photographing cactus bees, and that's a charismatic species, fine. But I spent so much time with the animal that I got more interested in it and started to look at the community it was in, and that was made up of dirt and ants and all these other little things that were happening there. And it, as a photographer, I was like, oh my God, this is, forget about the bee. There is a whole community of characters here, So for me, that just spurred me to try and go back into the toolbox of how can I tell this? Is it all gonna look the same? Because it's all this little stuff, how do I make it interesting? And again, I think it's really case specific. I haven't photographed a lot of plants, so that I don't know, but I do have a mentee that I've been working with who's photographing swamp cabbage. And she's doing her damnedest to make it interesting. She really is swamp cabbage, yeah. Yeah, and so we, she showed me the images, and we had to think about, what's the next shot? What's the next shot? What else can we find here? Is there something that uses it? Did you go out and when it was raining? You have to just try and find different ways to shoot the same thing another way.
Yeah.
When you asked about moral obligation, and I don't think we have a moral obligation to, tell a certain number of stories about a certain, kingdom on the tree of life. But I do think we have a moral obligation to tell stories about relationships. I mean, whether those are stories about relationships among species or whether they're about relationships between humans and other species, I mean, even if we have a story that's leaning on the, charisma or popularity or media moment of a single species, I see it as an obligation to go further and say, okay, how does this animal survive? What is its relationship with the humans around it? Is it positive or negative or both? And Stephen, I was just thinking about the story that we worked on together about coral restoration. And, you know, Stephen, I think, cleverly guided me toward, I wrote a story for Biographic about efforts to raise coral larvae in the lab and then plant them out in coral reefs. And coral reefs are charismatic. Coral larvae are not charismatic. And the process of raising them is super finicky and frustrating and kind of boring at times. But Stephen guided me toward a workshop held for young scientists from all over the Caribbean who were trying to do this. And their sort of camaraderie and then the stakes, the quixotic nature of what they were trying to do together, I think really helped drive that story and overcame some of the obstacles that were, they seemed like big obstacles at the beginning. And those elements in the story gave me a bigger element.
And sorry, can you just say one more beat on why you feel it is a moral obligation to tell stories about relationships and how to incorporate that?
Yeah, because that's what conservation's about, right? I mean, it's not about saving, you know, and people may disagree with this, but this is the way I think about it. Like, conservation is not about saving the last two individuals of a species. Like, conservation has failed if we get to that point, really. I mean, we may keep that genetic material on the planet, but the chances of our restoring a healthy population, we're not going to see it in our lifetimes, probably, unless it's a fruit fly. And so I feel like we need, the point of conservation is preserving relationships between healthy populations of species in their original habitat, not in captivity, not in, you know, tiny, tiny functionally extinct populations. So I try to emphasize that. No matter what my approach is, I do try to emphasize that in some way in my stories.
I want to talk about
On the legs of that, I think we talk about this word relationships, but I think a lot of people who are reading these stories don't even realize they have a relationship to their environments, right? So we need to get that across, that this isn't just a bee like that lives in the ground over there. It's a bee that lives in the ground where you drive your car and you drive over that burrow every day. So think about that in relationship to your own activities. And I think that's what we don't get enough of, is because people just feel like they live in their communities and their silos and their bubbles, but they don't have any concept of how what they do affects something else. I've got people who love bobcats, right? But they don't like rats, right? So they put rodenticide out. They have no concept that their rodenticide and the rats in their garages are killing the bobcats, okay? So it's those kinds of connective things that we need to start explaining.
And this just gets into the conversation about what even is nature, like nature as people define it as something distant that they have to go visit versus what's in their backyard. And I just think about this, I'm from Iowa, and it's the most ecologically transformed state in the country, arguably. And I discovered that there are river otters all over the place, and it was amazing to just be able to go, and I photographed them, and I had the best time, and it really shifted the way that I think about what a landscape looks like, or important ecosystems actually looks like. So there's nature everywhere, people think about it so differently. I want to talk a little bit about hope, maybe with you, Stephen, initially. I often feel like a lot of environmental stories are super negative, and then at the very end, there's like one paragraph. It's like, oh, but things aren't maybe that bad, or like, Rawa could be helpful, or whatever it is. And I'm just wondering, like, do we always need to add hope into our stories? And if so, like, where does that desire come from? Or can we just have a story that's just like, this is really bad and there is no solution right now? Like, how do you think about that as an outlet that does want to tell hopeful stories, or at least have a solution in the end?
Yes, I think we all know the type of story that you're talking about, Benji, where you get that final paragraph that just doesn't mesh with the rest of what you've read. It doesn't seem authentic. It feels very tacked on, and that's absolutely something that we try to avoid. I mean, in answer to your question, though, it is, I would say, the category of pitch that we pass on most frequently is nothing but issues, nothing but problems, this bad thing is happening, of course, we don't just dismiss it out of hand. We go back to the writer. We ask them to look into potential solutions, even if it's early on. It doesn't need to be a study or a conservation effort that has been going on for 10 years and there's all this positive evaluation on the effectiveness of it. It can be the very beginning, but we have to have something to follow along with. And if that doesn't materialize in that pitching process, then you know, we encourage them to pitch elsewhere, because it's really just not the kind of story that Biograph publishes. I mean, we probably would if we had a larger budget, but we have to be really, really selective, and we've kind of made a name for ourselves of being a solutions journalism type outlet and wanting to do it that way without being Pollyannish about it.
And more broadly speaking, maybe for Michelle, like, do you see hope as being something that needs to be in environmental stories, or can we tell stories without those aspects?
No, I'm against hope. No, actually, I wanted to say, I will say a word for bad news, because I think, I mean, there's, as we all know, there's a huge need for investigative work, and I think when you are exposing actual crimes against the environment, actual bad acting against the environment, then the exposure of that itself can be a thrill, can be a hopeful thrill for the audience who's reading it, thinking, God, you know, thank goodness these bastards are getting held to account. And it sort of, I think, it might not have a pick up the phone and call kind of action, but I think it galvanizes people in a way that is very useful. So I don't always think that we have to talk about solutions rather than bad things. We need to document the bad things too. And in fact, I think that can happen in the same story if you do it right and don't staple on a bit of hope at the end like we've been talking about. But I try, after reading a lot about the history of the modern conservation movement for my book, I realized that most people, even those we look back on today as having accomplished so much for conservation, they did not know it at the time. You know, Rachel Carson did not go around going, I'm Rachel Carson, I'm gonna change the world. I mean, she had a lot of uncertainty and heartbreak in her life, and there were many times when she didn't think she was mad at her publisher or didn't think she was gonna doing the right thing or didn't know if, you know, anyone was gonna pay attention to what she had to say. And so I think to assume that we need hope to do something worthwhile is a bit wrong-headed, and instead, I think we need opportunity for action. We need to provide opportunities to do the right thing by the systems that we depend on, and I think that's what we've been talking about here in terms of giving people a way to imagine themselves into participation in whatever we happen to be talking about, whatever system we happen to be talking about.
I just wanted to add one other thing about Biographical stories, and I think everything that I said is accurate when we're talking about a deep dive feature story that looks at issues. We want there to be an answer to the question, and then what? So what do we do about it? But we are also a publication, especially in the beginning, easily 50-50 straight natural history stories and half that were much more issues and about issues and solutions. But that the straight natural history, I feel, is just as important, because one of the things that we're talking about in terms of hope and inspiration is just kind of that wide-eyed celebration of, you know, the wonder of nature. And really great photography, again, allows us to do that, but also great writing does too, to introduce people to a species they've never seen before or a place they didn't know existed.
Yeah, and I will just say, like, on a personal note, when I get an opportunity to write about something wonderful and just really lean into the wonder of nature, it's so enjoyable for me, and I think that comes across in the writing, hopefully is infectious. So just from like a what I enjoy perspective, it's great. I want to turn to questions from the audience in a second, but maybe just first, Do you mind each just sharing one concrete example or concrete point of advice for what environmental journalists can do to get more people excited about biodiversity? Yeah. In their story.
I don't think I can do it on the storytelling platform, but I can tell you personal experiences. I teach photo workshops for kids, and I was teaching down in South Texas, and a lot of these kids don't even know that there's what a green jay is, and it's one of the most common birds down there. But anyway, I had a student, and I feel very strongly about the camera as a tool to connect people. Not just to an image, but the actual camera itself as a tool in your hands connects you to your environment. I had a little girl who didn't want to participate, and I gave her a macro lens on the camera, and we were looking for things to photograph. And it was middle of the day, there was nothing out, it was hot, and I finally found a spider. She hated spiders. She didn't want to go near the flower. We had a big discussion about it. I'm like, you have to have something today. So I got her on the ground with a macro lens, and she was struggling, and macro lens hard to use, and she's through it, and she's going, I can't find it. And she finally locked on, like, is it in focus? And there was like silence. She goes, oh my God, it has big eyes. And this went on for like 15 minutes, and I couldn't get her off. And she's like, this is so cool, it's hairs. So at the end of the workshop, that day, the kids got to print something, that they took. And I'm like, all right, what are we printing? She's like, the spider. I'm like, you hate spiders. She's like, no, I want to show it to my mom. So for me, I don't believe in hope, okay? I'm probably worse than everyone here in terms of my cynicism. But I do believe in making things cool for people, and I think the best way we can do that is with connection, whether it's through stories or the camera. And I know I went way off course on that, but it's about wonder and getting people interested, getting them to pay attention, getting them to activate, and then we, I don't believe in hope so much because we have so much history of what to do and not to do. So for me, it's not hope. We don't need hope. We need people to actually do something, to make decisions, better decisions, to hold people accountable. But like to hope that that's going to happen. We know what we're doing. So anyway, it's better for me just to work with children and animals. So.
Well, you're in trouble when I'm the most hopeful person on the panel. Because I don't think most of the people who know me would describe me in that way. In answer to your question, Benji, I think the most important thing we can do is to find ways to transport a reader to that place, to introduce them to the place, the people involved, the organisms that are there, and to give them a sense of why it matters in the first place. I think that idea of transporting someone there, obviously it's aided significantly if you have travel budget. Not everybody does. A lot of newsrooms don't. But looking for just creative ways to kind of get in that place mentally, whether it's, just interviewing your sources. Maybe it's a photographer who's spent a lot of time working there. A lot of our photo essay stories begin with just a set of images, and our reporting is usually remote for those, and so that reporting involves the journalist essentially interviewing the photographer who spent probably years covering that story to get a sense of what it looks like, what it smells like, what it feels like to be there.
One of my favorite characters to write about in my book was a woman named Rosalie Edge, who was a suffragist, a kind of upper class New Yorker who later in her life became a burr in the saddle of the Audubon Society, and she really shamed them because she thought that they were spending too much time covering species they liked and not enough time spending protecting species that they didn't like. And one of her favorites
sayings was that the best time to protect a species is while it's still common. And she was saying this back in the 20s and 30s. And I think we still are ignoring that reality. And I think if you can find stories that are about people relating to populations that, if not still common, are still healthy, and if you can find ways of telling stories about people trying to do their best by those populations and live sustainably alongside them and as part of the same ecosystem, you might not be delivering the same jolt to the adrenal glands that you will with the story of imminent extinction and, you know, rhinos being carried by helicopters and that kind of thing, and, you know, and people, you know, undergoing feats of daring due to save a species from extinction. But I think those stories have their own drama. It's quieter, it's a slower burn, but it's there, and it's ultimately, I think, the most rewarding experience for a reader because they come away from it thinking, I can do that, I can be a part of that, and I can see that it's really meaningful. I think people, when you hold out hope, that, you know, I think the reason why people don't like those, or we react to those stories that, like, document a problem in great detail and have one paragraph about what you can do is that readers are smart. They know, okay, that's not meaningful. That's just, like, that's just a gesture. I think people recognize when there is a genuine opportunity to repair ecosystems, and if we can portray those opportunities with care and if we can portray them vividly, I think those are the most powerful and lasting stories we can tell.
Let's leave it there. Thank you so much. This was such a fun and informative discussion. And now, if you guys have questions in the audience, just remember to say your name and who you are.
I think we have time for just a couple of questions.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Joseph Nickers. I'm a reporter for Frisk. I wanted to ask one frustrating thing for me, if I'm ever covering biodiversity, is this, I feel this pressure to, like, answer the question, why should people care, by turning to tropes about, like, ecosystem services and things like that. And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or, like, advice to people, like, how can we cover animals and biodiversity in a way that conveys their, like, inherent right to live and thrive regardless whether they serve humans?
Sorry, I'm talking a lot, but I'll say something quick about that, which is, congratulations on the National Magazine Award, by the way. Yay, Grist. I think that I was thinking about this when we were talking about how to show that species are important to people, because I feel like there's this rote way that we sometimes do it in stories where we're like, they're important to water quality, they're important to this and that, and that just kind of, as a reader, it just kind of flies over my head, like that doesn't seem to be related to my actual life. So I think we do want to show that we do want to keep reminding people that we are air breathers and water drinkers as well, and that we need these ecosystems. But I think we can, you know, and as the old trick goes, we can show that rather than telling it, you know, rather than putting it in, like, in a bullet point list. And then, yeah, and I think you're right, we need to get beyond, like, what good is this species, and find ways of demonstrating that it has its own good, you know, it has its own inherent value. And perhaps one way into that is the kind of individuation that we were talking about earlier.
As you asked that question, I think the only thing I can think of was inspire curiosity. Find something about whatever you're talking about to inspire the readers to be curious, to want to know more about that thing, and to look into it further. And you can do that with good writing. I mean, you tell a cool story, not to say why that animal is necessary and all that. I mean, just tell a good story about a species and make it interesting. Or maybe not a species, maybe a little ecosystem or what's in your backyard. I don't know, but I just keep thinking about this term, like, inspire curiosity, because that's what gets me to read. Good writing and not being told something I already know. If I see one more bobcat story that says the bobcat eats this, the bobcat does this, it's like, there are so many other things that you can be saying, you know, but go find those nuggets, you know, to get people interested.
All right, we have another question back.
Hi, Hi there. My name is Lindsay Bonds. I'm a writer at CR Magazine. This question is for Michelle. You mentioned allowing the reader to see themselves in the story. Could you just elaborate on that, especially when you're covering like some U.S. Fish and Wildlife proposal? Like, what are some ways that you kind of allow a broad audience of readers to kind of see themselves in some of these stories?
Hi, Lindsay. That's a great question. I think, and I'm trying to remember exactly what I was referring to when I said see themselves in the story. I think that can be any number of take any number of different forms. I mean, maybe you see yourself in a story like I was talking about with the lamprey. Like, maybe you recognize some kind of deep solidarity with this weird creature. You know, that, it's trying to do its thing just like I'm trying to do my thing. And in a story about policy, maybe it's making sure that you talk about the places and the people affected by that policy, not in a kind of tacked-on way, but that's integrated into the story so that it's clear, you know, what this like seemingly bureaucratic policy might end up, you know, creating. You know, what are its effects going to be on the proverbial ground? And I think that can go a long way toward convincing people that it's something they need to get involved with and care about. And I mean, I kind of like those policy stories because sometimes there are very concrete ways that people can get involved. And because not enough people get involved, a single person's, you know, letters from a single person and 10 of their friends can make a big difference. So, you know, I think those stories are worth telling. And it's worth finding an interesting way to tell them. One quick thing, I wrote about a study years ago that I've never forgotten, which said that fear appeals actually can be quite effective in getting people's attention, but you have to follow up with the right-sized action. It can't be too small because people know that that's meaningless, and it can't be too big because people get overwhelmed. But if you find something that is both clearly has the potential to be meaningful and is accomplishable in a reasonable amount of time, not like overthrow capitalism, you know, but just like here's what you can do this week, here's what you and your neighbors can get together and do, that's when the message takes hold. That's when the fear appeal actually helps and helps lead to action.
And I have one last question.
Sure, thanks. I'm Joe Barber with Open Sources Institute. I was quite interested in the making rattlesnakes cute idea, and how do you deal with appeals for animals that intrinsically aren't that cute? I mean, you know, great white sharks or giant river otters, they're terrifying, they aren't cute. They're, but I think that respect is a way to tell the story. They're a part of the system, and how can you talk about them without sort of cutifying them? And the other is on the usefulness aspect, showing that something that might otherwise not be that interesting, a fungus or bats in Austin are a great example. You know, how are they useful in a way that you might not have thought about? I mean, how can you tell those stories to make an animal more interesting, you know, if it's going to be the topic of what you're talking about?
I'm not sure I caught all of that. In reference to the rattlesnakes, I was a little tongue-in-cheek that we were trying to make them cute, but I mean, except that was my response to it. I just knew that my response was subjective in that we have these adorable tiny little snakes, which, you know, they look like miniature versions of the adults, except, you know, the scale and proportion is a little different. But I think, so again, I don't think our job is to try to convince people that an animal like that is cute necessarily, but important and interesting, kind of in its own right. I think it just doesn't hurt that I'm infinitely fascinated by animals, how they came to be, and how they kind of make a living in their environment.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way to make rattlesnakes cute, but rattlesnake females actually stay with their babies, right? They protect their babies for I forget the term for it, but they actually give birth to live babies, and then they stay with them for a week to just sort of guard them. And most people don't know that, most people think, oh my God, it's a snake, it lays eggs, and then it goes away. But so when you start to make these little connective things that, that people understand, right, taking care of your babies, right, they say, oh, wow, that's interesting. Oh, I hate snakes, but that's kind of cool. So for me, and like, you know, most of the times I'm not a writer. I don't write stories, but I do write my little, you know, Instagram tidbits. And it's then that I tell those things. And it's just, for me, it's just, again, it's making those connections. I'm not trying to make an animal something that it's not. But like you said, and I think is a great word, is respect, right? Making a living. That animal, that creature, that plant, that whatever, makes a living in a space that we might not understand anything about, but the readers and the photographers, it's our job to bring them there somehow, right? And I want to throw this out there because I see this a lot. Be very careful of the words you use when you talk about certain species. Because a lot of times you're perpetuating a stereotype when you use aggressive words, for example, with predators. You know, the bobcat snarls. Well, really? You know, and then I'll right away, psychologically, it's an aggressive, mean animal, right? But that's not true, you know? So just be careful of that stuff, because that's when those stereotypes continue. And I was just thinking of that as, you know, as we were talking along the way, so that's not totally answering your question, but.
Let's thank our panelists. Thank you so much.